Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, San Francisco's oldest, most innovative public radio station.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, in this case, under a big lotus tree.
And from the lotus tree, we calmly migrate to the air, and from the air to our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where from time to time we both weigh in. Check it out.
And Ken, it's time for you to quit contemplating your navel and start talking to me about Zen Buddhism.
Oh, Zen Buddhism. You know, I read somewhere, some people in the Zen circle say Zen has no philosophy. Zen is not a philosophy. Somebody says it's beyond philosophy. It's beyond reasoning, rationality, beyond logic. So what are we doing talking about it? And it can't be put into words exactly. You can just experience it.
Yeah, some people say Zen is ineffable. But when somebody tells me they've got some ineffable truths, I say, well, I bet I can eff them. At least I can have a lot of fun trying. I think philosophy is capable of discussing everything. So when somebody says, oh, you can't discuss the philosophy of Zen, I say, watch us try.
Yeah. I do have to say, philosophically, there is one thing about Zen that, there are actually a couple things that about Zen, as I understand it, that and Buddhism in general, that fascinate me. You know, Christianity has a lot of bizarre metaphysics. Christ didn't say it had a lot of bizarre metaphysics, but the theology of Christianity has posited a lot of metaphysics. But I was reading some teachings of the compassionate Buddha, and there's this little thing in there where one of the disciples says to the master, but master, you haven't told me whether the world is infinite or finite, whether it's eternal or non-eternal, whether what's good and what's evil, so how can I practice? And the master says, basically, that's irrelevant. Of course I didn't tell you that stuff. Just practice, find contentment and enlightenment, so you don't need all that metaphysics. It's, you know,
I think it may be quite true that Buddhism in general, or at least some kinds of Buddhism in general, and Zen in particular, is a lot less free of implausible and problematic metaphysics than a lot of religions. But that doesn't mean we can't discuss it philosophically. We can ask, well, what is this Zen enlightenment, and how does it fit into the world, and why doesn't it need those metaphysics?
Well, that's true. I mean, because this Zen enlightenment, especially if it really is supposed to be, I mean, I'm a philosopher. I want to understand the world. I want to understand it philosophically. I want to reason about it. I want to do science on it. I think that's the path to understanding. Well, and this stuff where you just experience, and it's beyond lot, I'm really puzzled about what that is and how that's supposed to work and how you could ever get yourself in that frame of mind.
Well, maybe we better get a little dose of enlightenment to get started, Ken.
Yeah, and roving philosophical reporter Amy Standen went out and talked to somebody who's achieved a degree of enlightenment through Zen. She files this report.
I grew up in Ireland, and after I finished college and worked for a couple of years, I decided to travel, and I ended up traveling to Japan.
Paul Heller is an abbot at the San Francisco Zen Center.
By that point in time, questions like, well, what is life about? And noticing how everywhere you went, there were different cultures, different sensibilities about what life was and what life wasn't. So my mind was quite philosophical and open. In fact, I was chewing my way through Nietzsche's writings. And that seemed to be, for me, for my mind, the perfect primer to hearing the teachings of Buddhism. When I was living in Tokyo and met someone who was training to be a Zen priest, I was sitting in a Chinese restaurant and he approached me. I think he wanted to practice his English, and we became friends. We talked about suffering, the meaning of life, and what we were doing with our lives. He gave me a rather obscure book on Zen koans, and for some reason, when I started to read it, I felt like this is it. This is the answer to all the questions. It wasn't actually the answer to the questions, but it reframed them in a way that really made sense to me. From that moment, I just felt like how Zen relates to life, the way it responds to the human condition, is how I want to live. What are we trying to do throughout the day? To wake up, to be present in the moment, in this time and space, for what's happening, and then to carry that awareness, whatever we're doing. So the notion in Zen is that everything you do is an opportunity to be aware. We all have moments of enthusiasm, moments where the experience that's arising right now has a vitality that draws us forth. You know, you read the Zen of skiing, or you read NBA basketball players having a Zen moment as they dunk the ball, or whatever. I mean, of course, this is nothing other than the capacity of our lives Zen practice is simply to take that and try to make it a recurring event rather than a unique and fleeting and rare experience. When you start to take it on as a deliberate practice, it does feel like you're trying to do something unnatural. As you continue with it, you actually discover that not only is it not robbing you of something, it's actually giving you a gift, because our preoccupations are their own kind of limitation, and that the present moment is where we are fully alive. The more we all experience being alive, the happier we will be, the more generous we will be with each other, the more compassionate, and the more we will have an insight into what's important in life.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks, Amy, for that report. So, Ken, we've got a little enlightenment fodder for our philosophical mill. Let's get started. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. And we're joined today by Robert Scharf. He's the chair of the Center for Buddhist Studies at UC Berkeley, where he also teaches in the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures. He's also author of Coming to Terms with Chinese Buddhism. Bob, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Bob, thanks for coming over from that great university across the bay to join us here today at Philosophy Talk. Now, for us kind of anxiety-ridden analytic philosophers full of metaphysical obsessions, Buddhism in general, and Zen Buddhism in particular, can be a little bit weird. Why don't you take a minute or half a minute and give us a little basic lesson in the geography here. Is Buddhism a religion? Is Zen Buddhism a religion? Or is Zen Buddhism a lifestyle? Or what?
Well, one of the reasons that seems to be a complex problem is because the terms religion and philosophy don't really work so well, not only for Zen, but for Buddhism and for many Asian traditions. They're terms that were generated out of the West. Our model of a religion is Christianity, where faith is really central to the very notion of salvation. Buddhism started roughly 2,400 years ago, around 400 BC in India. And the central moment in Buddhism is the enlightenment of the Buddha. And as a practitioner of Buddhism, what you're supposed to do is recreate that moment, is to have the same insight that the Buddha had, which really means that faith isn't central. And that's one of the problems with calling Buddhism a religion.
Okay, but now Buddhism has a lot of forms, and some of them seem full of philosophical and metaphysical doctrines, reincarnation in Tibetan Buddhism, and all sorts of things like that. Is Zen Buddhism free of all of that?
Well, to talk about Zen looks a little strange because Zen begins with a critique of the Buddhism that came before. So look a bit at central Buddhist notions. One of them is that everything is changing all the time. One of them is that there is no self. One of them is that desire is the problem. So people can ask, if you're meditating as a Buddhist, isn't the desire for enlightenment or the desire to achieve some state, isn't that itself an impediment? Someone might say, if you're doing meditation and trying to train the mind to understand that there is no self, who is that person that is trying to train the mind? So Zen comes about by looking at some of the early Buddhist doctrines, and really it's a very philosophical approach in that they're trying to render more consistent some basic Buddhist ideas. But it ends up looking a little strange.
Yeah, so I mean, tell me if I've got this wrong. I understand that Zen says, don't worry so much about the scriptures, so about text and doctrine. And there's this kind of direct link through a Zen master. I'm a disciple. I study with some Zen master, and I'm supposed to experience this enlightenment. And it goes from master to student to master to student without all this doctrinal heavy stuff. Is that right?
Well, let me throw in a little bit of history. So Buddhism starts in India around the 4th century BC. Zen starts in China around the 8th century AD. So a lot of
time. 1,200 years, something like that. 13.
Roughly.
Yeah, yeah.
People debate the origins. But when the Chinese say that you don't need to read scriptures, it was a little bit self-serving because they knew that they didn't have access to all of the scriptures that were coming out of India. So there is a sense in which they were dealing with an interpretation problem. They were so far away from the source of Buddhism that they were seeking a way to re-enliven.
So it's like, even if we can't read the scriptures, we can still have this.
And we don't need to read Indian scriptures. Yeah. We don't need Indian teachers, because enlightenment is something that actually exists in all of us. One can't achieve enlightenment, according to at least the major Zen school. One can only realize what you already have.
So in some ways, then, Zen is like Christianity, and at least they both have a central form of something that in Christianity is called salvation, right? Makes you different. Now, in Zen Buddhism, it's enlightenment. Tell us more about enlightenment. I take it it's not what you get by studying real hard, like if you're, you know, taking a math class and all of a sudden everything falls into shape. I'd say, I've got enlightenment. But that's not what Zen enlightenment is like, I guess.
There's two aspects to Buddhist enlightenment. And in this sense, Zen is not unlike most other forms of Buddhism. One is what is called insight, which is you have to achieve insight into the nature of the world. And in early Buddhist doctrine, that insight meant insight into the nature of impermanence, insight into the fact that there is no self, there is no abiding soul or cogito. We're just a continual, we're people in flux continually. The other aspect of enlightenment is meditation. It's believed that you can't achieve this kind of analytic insight without training the mind. So there's a certain kind of just rote discipline involved in taming the mind so that this insight is possible. So it really cuts in between a kind of what we would think of as philosophy and what we would think as a kind of rigorous ascetic or ritual practice.
Now, you mentioned the cogito. That's a big moment in Western philosophy. That's when Descartes finds that the one thing whose existence he cannot doubt is his self. Even if the whole world doesn't exist, there's got to be a self there who mistakenly believes it does exist. And he says, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am.
Or if he was on philosophy talk, he'd say cogito ergo blog.
But yes, that's exactly. Right. Or blago. But how can, I mean, so Zen couldn't be more different than modern philosophy, if modern philosophy starts with the discovery of the self, and Zen kind of centers on appreciating all the implications of the Buddhist rejection of the self.
Yeah, they're not saying that somehow this is all an illusion and we'll wake up someday mm-hmm. and discover that we're in some virtual matrix world. What they're saying is that the notion that there is an abiding, continuous, somehow stable self is an illusion. So they'd say Descartes had a thought that I am, and it was simply Descartes' transient passing thought through his mind that he exists.
So they're not saying Descartes doesn't exist. They're not saying the person doesn't exist. They're saying this kind of immaterial substance is not part of their worldview.
But I think it's really more complicated than that, because tell me if I've got this right. I understand. Again, I don't at all claim to be an adept or a master or an aficionado, just a shallow dabbler. So I may have this completely wrong. But every time I read any sort of philosophical gloss on Buddhism, I don't quite get this from Buddhist original scriptures or anything, but from philosophical gloss, I think consciousness for the Buddhists is sort of like a problem to be overcome. It's kind of a stage that we have to get beyond, because that consciousness divides everything, the I versus you, the subject versus the object, and we have to get beyond that. And after the break, I'll give you a chance to tell me if I've got that completely wrong or not. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is Zen. Our guest is Robert Scharf, Chair of the Center for Buddhist Studies at UC Berkeley.
We'd love to hear from the Zen Buddhists out there. This is San Francisco. There must be some of you listening to our show that have had various degrees of Zen enlightenment. What do you see as the philosophy of Zen Buddhism? How has it changed your life? And, of course, we'd love to hear from the skeptics, too.
We'll take your calls in a moment. Philosophy Talk will be right back.
The Incredible String Band with This Moment. This moment, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing Zen Buddhism. Join us at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Call us and tell us how Zen Buddhism has touched your life or how you wished it would.
Our guest is Robert Scharf, author of coming to terms with Chinese Buddhism. But I want to my question before the break. John was talking about this Cartesian moment where we get this Cartesian ego that knows itself as the primary object of its own awareness, right? And there, but that moment's a really big moment in Western philosophy, because not only is it the primacy of the ego, but the world outside the ego becomes this lifeless thing. Other minds become a problem. So here I am knowing myself. Are there other minds out there? That's a problem for me, right? And the world that's not mine is lifeless, is dead. And it's like, how's it get there? You know, what's it doing there? And I always think of, maybe I'm wrong about this. I always think that Buddhism in sort of enlightenment is tied up with unity and realizing your oneness with all things. And that suggests to me that it sees this Cartesian consciousness as a kind of problem to be overcome. I mean, to get to enlightenment, overcome this duality of self and others, knowing subject and dead object. Is that right or wrong?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by consciousness, and I certainly don't know what you mean by distinction between consciousness. I mean, you seem to be talking about something that's happening on the little screen inside our brain somewhere and the world outside. That is a distinction that, to be quite honest, I don't get it. I look out and I see color out there in the world. Does that color exist out there in the world, or is it something that is processed inside my brain? Now, quite clearly, it's neither. You need the eye, you need the photons that are coming in, you need the particular retinal structure that we have, you need the brains that we have. But from a Buddhist point of view, consciousness is happening right along that spectrum between the two poles, which means the distinction between consciousness and world doesn't really make any sense. What they're trying to do in their meditative practice is for that to become real, palpable, so that they live that.
So this really, in my continuing attempt to fit Zen Buddhism into Western philosophy, this really sounds like William James' Essays in Radical Empiricism, or the British version of it, Neutral Monism, that what there fundamentally is experience. Now, you probably, as a Zen aficionado, don't like the fundamentally is part, but is there a connection there between that kind of radical empiricism of William James and the Zen picture?
Well, people have tried to make the connection. In fact, many of the people who were most influential in bringing Zen to America, people like D.T. Suzuki, who was the person who turned on a whole generation, the Beats, in the 50s and 60s, to Zen, he had read William James. There's a very popular philosophical movement in Japan called Kyoto Philosophy. It was started by a philosopher called Nishida Kitaro. He had read William James. So part of the notion that Zen is pure experience, Zen is that the immediacy, the nowness of things, that's actually being digested, as it were, through a certain Western philosophical thinkers, and that's precisely why it's so appealing to us. One thing I'd say to make the situation a little more complicated is Zen is also a path. Simply understanding something is very different from being able to put it into practice. And it's one thing to have some philosophical understanding that the distinction between self and other, or between the world and consciousness, doesn't really make sense. It's another thing to actually transform your being so that that becomes palpably real from moment to moment.
So enlightenment is connected to this philosophical view, but it doesn't consist in accepting the philosophical view. William James may have been pretty right about it, but he probably wasn't enlightened. He was a nervous guy.
Yeah, I mean, plus, as a matter, I plead only, shallow
okay.
understanding.
Okay.
You
Say
know,
it.
I'm in the presence of more masterful understanding, and I bow to the master. You know, like that's what I'm supposed to do, right? Bow to the master. But it's a way of being. It's a way of being that's also a way of knowing that doesn't make that distinction in a way. I mean, we have like a way of knowing, plus a way of being, and Zen says, look, there is a way of being that's simultaneously a way of knowing, a way of knowing that's simultaneously a way of being, and that's what you're supposed to achieve. Is that?
Yes, but there's the danger that I see, and here I'm speaking as a scholar of Buddhism, is when a particular understanding of Zen, the notion that Zen is pure experience, it's simply being in the moment, moves into a kind of narcissistic self-help, new age meism. And that's where I'd say that's not what enlightenment is about. Enlightenment is about being, is acting from moment to moment to moment without attachments. And that's actually a very radical way of being, and it's traditionally a way that was intended only for monastics who had given up family, who did not have children, who did not have worldly concerns, who didn't have to make a living in the world, that path was considered to be essential for this particular understanding. When you extract it, you turn it into a notion of experience that will somehow help you be a better father, a better lover, better able to appreciate your ski experience, or a better NBA basketball player, for example, I really question whether that can make any claim to be a legitimate understanding of Zen.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Zen Buddhism with our guest Robert Scharf from the University of California at Berkeley. We have an email that's right on this topic from Pete in San Francisco. He says, there's much I admire about Zen Buddhism, and I've always felt there is something presumptuous and even superior about it, however. That is, Zen seems to place disengagement, perfect harmony, and balance in some abstract notion of enlightenment on a pedestal. I feel compelled to look at and engage in reality all the time, the dirty parts and the clean parts. What do you think about that?
I'm on his side. I think that if you actually entered a traditional Zen monastery, life is pretty down and dirty. You've got to deal with the guy sitting next to you who breathes too loud. You've got to deal with the crappy food. You've got to deal with an incredibly rigorous routine, getting up at 3:30, 4 in the morning, enduring intense cold. We're not talking about something that is in any way easy or is in any way really detached from the world. It's moments like that, dealing with the fact that the guy next to you has bad breath. That's where you're supposed to enact enlightenment. That's where you're supposed to enact detachment.
Well, this enlightenment is sounding more and more useful. It's going to make me a better father, better skier, and better able to deal with bad breath.
Paul in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question regarding meditation specifically, and the idea that meditation is a unique type of empirical or epistemic practice. And the idea there is that it's claimed that there is, you know, some kind of knowledge that's gained by meditation or mindfulness that is not gained by other types of practices or activities. And I'm wondering how Zen Buddhism in particular, or just Buddhism in general, responds to the accusation that knowledge gained by meditation isn't simply some kind of unwarranted form of, you know, argument from authority, or, you know, some type of mysticism where, you know, basically you just have to, you know, believe on trust the person who claims to have this insight.
Well, do you think it could be like, you know, knowing what color red is? I mean, somebody could tell you what color red is, but you really have to experience it to know what it's like. Could enlightenment be like that, and that's why it's sort of ineffable?
Why don't we let Bob have a chance to answer that? What do you think, Bob? Thanks, Paul.
There are many different kinds of meditation in Buddhism, and there's a lot of disputes between different teachers as to which kinds are appropriate and which kinds are simply instilling ideas about the world. But more fundamentally, as I said earlier on, Buddhism has two different approaches which have to be done in tandem traditionally. One is meditation, which is really training the mind, and it's disciplining the mind. And in some sense, that's not where insight comes from. Insight comes out of a particular analytic understanding of the world that is done in conjunction with meditation. So I'd say one might say that Buddhism does not claim that meditation in and of itself brings any ultimate understanding of the world. It has to be done in conjunction with a certain kind of deep analysis.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Zen Buddhism with our guest, Robert Scharf. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. Or outside the Bay Area, you can call 1-800-525-9917. And we have William on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, William.
Yes, thank you very much. Obviously, from what your very knowledgeable guest has said, there are various ways of practicing Buddhism. I have a question. How, for instance, if you were to compare Buddhism with liberation theology, as practiced by some Catholics, where they say in Central America that there's a fundamental socioeconomic injustice and here's what has to be changed, how would a Buddhist approach that situation?
What do you think?
Is your idea, William, that Buddhists tend to think that the world isn't out there to be fundamentally changed by our activities, that it differs from the kind of liberation theology idea that we can change the world?
The image that I've had, and I'm recognizing that it may be incorrect, is that the concept, suffering is natural and you should learn to 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 enjoy it seems silly, but you should learn to accept it. Whereas, say, liberation, and that can get into a situation which reminds me of, you know, don't pay attention to this world, you'll be rewarded in the next world, you know, sing a few, you know, Negro spirituals and it'll be okay.
Okay, all right. And, that's a good point, William. Thanks.
You know, one of my teachers in undergraduate school, when I was reading Nietzsche and Nietzsche railing against religion, said Nietzsche really had in mind not so much Christianity but Buddhism, and he hated the rise of Buddhist influence in European philosophy in the 19th century through Schopenhauer and stuff like that, precisely partly because of this problem. What do we think about that?
Well, the history of Buddhism is not that dissimilar as an institution from the history of the Christian Church or the Catholic Church, in that Buddhism spread often by forming very self-serving alliances with state interests. And there's been a fairly large controversy in the last little while when it was discovered in the West by many Zen practitioners that the Zen institution in Japan had been wholeheartedly in support of the military activity in the Second World War. But there's also an ideological strand in Buddhism which says you can't preach the Dharma, meaning you can't preach the teachings of the Buddha, to an empty stomach.
Let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Nancy, what do you got to say about all this?
Hi. I read a book a number of years ago that really certainly changed my driving habits, called Zen and the Art of Driving. And I recommend this book that should be required for any new driver getting their driver's license.
Well, what was the basic message that had the big influence on your driving?
The basic message is that you just kind of have to go with the flow and stay calm and, you know, really kind of zero in to your own driving and, you know,
but it must emphasize, too, that you should be very aware of what's going on. That's something that comes through with a lot of Zen stories.
Right,
is very expect
aware, and just not, I don't drive fast anymore. I don't get upset at other drivers. I look at the bigger picture of, you know, if I get somewhere a little late, you know, it's...
Well, Nancy, thanks for that. I hope I meet you on the freeway.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure Zen driving can be. I don't know. It could be a little dangerous. Anyway, Bob, you're cracking up here.
Well, I'm thinking if you're in a Zen monastery, and I don't mean to belittle this particular book. I don't know the book. But if you're in a Zen monastery and you're sort of in your own space going with the flow, just being with the moment, there's a good chance someone's going to come up with a big stick and whack you over the shoulder.
I want to go back to this question about Zen sort of indifferentism, if you will, or Buddhist indifferentism. So you know, it says Buddhism in various forms, unity with the moment. And we have this distinction between, you know, me and you. And that gives rise to all sorts of problems, right? I resent you. You resent me. We anger. We argue back and forth. We dispute. All this division. That's part of, though, it comes with consciousness. My consciousness is over there, yours is over there. Zen wants you to transcend all that. But now it's hard, you know. So if I just appreciate the moment, what about the moment when you're stabbing me in the heart? Am I supposed to just say, there's the universe manifesting itself again, right? I mean, it sounds like, when you read Buddhist texts, it sounds like sometimes you should say, well, there's the universe doing its thing,
well,
right? But that seems so antithetical to Western ears.
Well, there's this one story I read where a Zen master is sitting there and a criminal comes in and says, I could run this knife right through you. And the Zen master says, I'm the kind of person you could run a knife right through.
Yeah, so, right, exactly. There's this poem by Byron, I think.
That's helpful.
If the Red Slayer thinks he has slain or is slain, right, he knows not well the subtle ways I rise and do something again, right? So it's all one.
There has been, for the last 1,000 years, there's been a debate going on within the Zen Buddhist community about precisely this. The two sides on it were, there was the quiet sitting side, and they believed somehow that the object was to sit there through thick or thin. And this takes the form nowadays of, not so much ethically, but in terms of the practice, the Soto Zen. The San Francisco Zen Center, for example, is associated with the Soto Zen School in Japan, and they believe in just sitting. This is a sort of a dogma that they hold, although, of course, they would insist that it's not a dogma. The other school, historically, is the Sudden Enlightenment School, which nowadays takes the form, or its sort of instantiation is the Rinzai School. And they tend to emphasize much more involvement in the world. Now, of course, ethically, they would both, at this point, both insist that they are very much involved with the world, that they are moving in the same direction as liberation theology, in fact, in believing that there has to be a proactive social commitment among Buddhists.
But that's just the reality. How does that fit with the idea that it's all one, that, you know, the division between you and I, this and that, me and the object, is somehow artificial and something to, if we see more deeply?
Because if you recognize that the suffering of other people, if you really see it truly, you suffer with them. And it is just as painful for you to see others suffer as it would for you to suffer yourself. So the basic injunction, and this goes back to very fundamental Buddhist teachings, is act in the world so that you minimize the suffering of other human beings.
Bob, let's just stop for a minute and get a little bibliography here. Now, when I was a student, I read D.T. Suzuki. He's got essays on Zen Buddhism and probably some other books you can get at your local bookstore. And also Alan Watts, but I don't hear so much about him anymore. What are the good introductory books our listeners might look at?
Well, Alan Watts has certainly fallen out of favor. There's a book written by it's actually an edited version of the talks by the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which has become somewhat of a classic among North American Buddhists. And it's not so much, it doesn't really deal with the history or philosophy of Zen Buddhism, but it certainly deals with the ethos. It recreates the feeling as much as it's possible through words of what Zen practice is about.
Ken, you've been reading a book you like a lot. What's that?
Well, actually, I've been reading this book by Nishitani called Religion and Nothingness. Nishitani is a big philosopher in the Kyoto school that you think is not so...
Well, this is where...
I wouldn't call that a beginner's book, though.
Yeah,
hard book.
This gets into controversies within my own field. This is where, as a scholar, I'd say that Nishitani is creating a kind of strange hybrid between traditional Zen thought and Buddhist thought and also Western thought. And the hybrid I don't find very cogent or convincing. I think it attracts a lot of people precisely because it is a hybrid, because it looks like he's making philosophical moves, and yet he has the authority of a Zen teacher.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Zen Buddhism with Robert Sharfa, director of the Center for Buddhist Studies at UC Berkeley.
What is Zen meant in your life? Does it take you away from the world? Does it drive you into the world? What do you like, Rinzai, Soto Zen? Call and give us your opinion.
More calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Going down, and the eyes in his head, see the world spinning round.
The Beatles and Fool on the Hill. I'm John Perry, one of your local Philosophy Corner fools. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence and sometimes John's humor. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing Zen with Robert Char from the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures at UC Berkeley. Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Don't be left out just because you're outside the Bay Area listening on the internet or something like that. Call 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
And MK in Foster City's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, MK. You there, MK? I think we've lost MK.
How about Pablo in San Francisco?
Hi,
Pablo. What's your comment or question?
Well, you know, I was just curious. It's a great show, by the way, as always.
Thanks for that.
Something where my own bent tends to be leaning towards. But would it be possible to, based on what your guest has presented as the formation of Buddhism in China, to continue that thread on so that one could say, well, I don't need any kind of scripture. I don't need any kind of master, and I can just develop my own and say that this is, you know, and this is what fits into that tradition, and have it possibly be sort of cogent or harmonious with that, so that we could do away with this concept of scripture and masters.
So, Pablo, I hear two different things there. Could we just not have a scripture, or could each person invent his own scripture, his own little story to go with it?
Well, you don't need the text, though. Scripture is text, so you just need the experience and the practice, I take it. Bubble
say. Right.
What do you think, Bo?
Well, remember that in the 8th century, in the 9th century, when they began to take this very, what sounds like a very radical or antinomian stance and say, we don't need textures, we don't need teachers, and that you have Zen masters saying things like, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha. These were people who were ordained Buddhist monks living in monasteries and maintaining a very strict discipline. It's very different from when contemporary Westerners, and this is why Alan Watts has come out of fashion, by the way. He's seen to be a prime example of this. Says, we don't need texts, we don't need rituals, we don't need institutions, we don't need anything. Enlightenment is somehow right here in the moment. There's a very different ethical stance involved and a very different sort of soteriological.
The Protestant in me says, well, that's how it should be. You know, Catholic doctrine says you need all these intermediaries between you and God. You need this tradition of interpreting the scripture. You need these priests that dispense this sacrament. And the Protestant in me, the fallen away Protestant, says, wait a minute. If God's so great and so imbuing of the world and the faithful and the pure-hearted with grace, why can't I just be pure of heart and let him deliver grace upon me? I don't need all that stuff.
But Luther translated the Bible. I mean, Protestants like the scripture. You used the word antinomian a minute ago, and I'm a little worried Ken doesn't know what that means.
Ken, antinomian refers to a kind of rejecting fundamental teachings of the tradition. And often Zen people use rhetoric. For example, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha. And what they mean by that is if you think that enlightenment or understanding is something that you can get outside of yourself, knock that down. The Buddha there means enlightenment. And it has to come from within.
Exactly what I thought it meant.
Yeah, right. Ruhama in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Oh, hi. This is a great show. Thank you. Now I got a lot of stuff going on in my mind, but one of them, just sort of referring to what the last caller said, is that I think it's like, even though it's kind of a, this is a paraphrase, probably not an exact quote from the Great Liberation Sutra, which is a Tibetan scripture that's a whole lot like Zen. And says, even though all sentient beings have Buddha essence, in other words, enlightenment is really here all the time and everybody all the time, they say not until the seed is pressed, like sesame seed is the source of oil and milk the source of butter, not until the seed is pressed and the milk churned do the oil and butter appear. So you have to do something to get out of the way to let that happen.
So I've got the enlightenment in me, and I just have to get the garbage out of the way, and then it'll come out, and I'll be enlightened. That's kind of comforting.
That enlightenment, I don't think it's like, then I'll be enlightened. Like, that's the end of the story.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that's not my view anyway. But really what I called about before was when someone else was asking about liberation theology and so on. And I think it's really important that, it's hard to understand for us, but that my understanding in Buddhism is that compassion is not feeling sorry for people. It's not like being sympathetic to people. It's not like, oh, you poor thing, I need to help you before I can help myself. Or like the Bodhisattva vow, it's not like, you know, oh, I'm going to wait to be enlightened because I have to help all these other people first, because that would be a very dualistic view.
But Ruhama, what is it? You told me what it isn't.
No, it's like the wisdom basis. It's like the experiential understanding that there really is no difference between you and other beings. And the Bodhisattva thing, it's not like a prescription. It's not like saying you can't be enlightened until everybody is. It's just like sort of gravity. It's just like the way it is. The way it is that we are also interconnected. So, I'm not having feelings. I have time to explain anything, but it's like the idea that I don't exist as an individual, or things don't exist as an individual.
So, Ruhama, it sounds like you, Zen Buddhism plays a big role in your life, or at least Buddhism.
Well, I would say similar, but not exactly that in that school.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Cynthia is on the line. Cynthia in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Cynthia.
Well, hello. I'm a lawyer. I was invited 6 years ago to go to Bhutan to draft the first environmental protection law for the country.
Wow.
Yeah.
Based on Buddhist principles?
Yes, exactly.
Well, how did that work? I mean, what's involved in Buddhist principles on the environment?
Well, I think the interconnectedness of all being and the loss of ego is essential to, in the transition from a monarchy to a democratic government, which they were in the middle of at the time. And the law was to provide a basis through which the emerging forces in society could resolve their conflicts and find common ground.
So it sounded like it dealt not just with the environment, but with the way people interacted with each other and all sorts of things.
Exactly, and how can you separate them?
Now, were you a Buddhist going over there? Is that why they chose you?
No, I was an environmental lawyer who'd worked in about 20 different countries at the time, mostly in Eastern Europe.
Well, thanks, Cynthia. That's extremely interesting.
What was most important in the whole process was this practice of getting out of the way so that you can hear what people are telling you and so that you can, in a sense, allow the correct path to reveal itself before you.
Well, thanks very much, Cynthia. So, Bob, why don't you make one last comment and we'll have to say goodbye.
People have raised this notion of bodhisattva. There is central to Buddhism the notion that if you really listen to other people, if you really come into touch with other people, you will respond very deeply to their suffering. And that response to their suffering is the actualization of non-self or non-personhood. And this is where the ethics and the philosophy...
Well, on that very compassionate-sounding note, I'm going to have to say goodbye to you. Thanks so much for joining us, Robert.
Thanks a lot, Robert.
Our guest has been Robert Scharf of the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures at UC Berkeley. He's the author of Coming to Terms with Chinese Buddhism.
And we want to thank Robert Scharf, and we also want to thank all the callers who called and the ones we talked to and also the ones we weren't able to get to. A lot of callers today.
Yeah, there were a whole list. This topic touched the chord, hit a chord with
somebody.
Touched
the chord. Well, California, after
all. So what did you learn today, John?
Well, I would say I didn't change my mind about much, but I deepened my understanding, I hope. It seems to me that Zen is actually a religion that is full of philosophical, not doctrines in the sense that, you know, an immortal soul or reincarnation or the supernatural or the omnipotent, omniscient God are doctrines, but maybe much more plausible but still philosophical doctrines about the nature of kindness, the nature of satisfaction, the nature of experience. So I think Zen is a glorious thing for philosophers to discuss.
Oh, I think it is too. I mean, it certainly is a glorious thing. I wish we could have talked more about the Buddhist ethic because, again, in reading about this stuff, I mean, actually for a while, since I was an undergraduate, it's always puzzled me. This business of like overcoming consciousness, overcoming the subject-object distinction and all that, that seems important, but in some ways it seems like a measure of, can lead you to indifferentness, you know, because it's all one to me how the universe goes. But we had this, there is this deeply compassionate side too. I just think that's a really complicated thing that I wish we had more time to untangle. But you know what? Maybe we can untangle some of it on our blog.
Absolutely.
The blog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think therefore I blog. Go check it out.
Here with the last word on Zen is a chant called Heart Sutra. This was recorded at the Kwan Um School of Zen in Cumberland, Rhode Island.
Terrible headache. My head is just pounding like crazy. It's like 100 horses in there.
Ken, that's not your head pounding. That's not 100 horses. That's the phone ringing. It's the conundrum time. Somebody's got a problem they want us to help them with.
Oh, and we have a caller on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alex.
Hi.
Where are you calling from, Alex?
Northern Virginia.
So what do you do out there?
I code.
You code? Like you...
computer program.
Okay, so what's your conundrum, Alex?
Let's say there was a teleporter, like used in Star Trek, that disassembled all the atoms in your body and sent them somewhere else and reassembled them. Would this new assemblage of atoms still be you?
Right. So I think philosophically, there's some questions we have to answer first. Would that body be the very body that was disassembled? Looks like you could give two answers. I mean, if I take my car all apart and lay it out on the driveway in order to, shine up every single part and then put it all back together, it's still the same car. But can you do that with live things? Take them all apart and put them together? Are they still the same? And the second question is, how about the mind part of it? Is this guy that's teleported on Star Trek usually had the memories of the person who stepped into the teleporter? And you want that to be the case, don't you, Alex?
Yeah.
So, okay, maybe it could be the same memories. You've got the same body, the same memories. the same character, you know, the same person. What's so hard about that?
Yeah, let's bite and say it's the same person. I have a feeling you have a surprise in store for us.
Well, then the next question is, it's hard to send atoms. What if they just write down exactly which atoms are where and send that data? And so they just rebuild a new you exactly the same but out of different atoms.
Yeah. Well,
that's still you.
It sounds like a slippery slope argument.
Yeah, it's a good question. Here's one way it could go. They take a map of your atoms and they send that information. They say, build a new being according to exactly this map. And what happens to the first one? Well, maybe it gets destroyed. If the first one gets destroyed, I'd have the intuition, well, it's me again. But suppose there are two of them. Suppose that there was actually an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation like this.
Yeah, malfunction. There's two of them. I have a feeling that's your third question, wasn't it, Alex?
Yeah.
They built two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we say it's the same if there's just one, but it's not if there's just two? This is, in philosophy, this is called the problem of the competitor. Somebody's competing with you for your identity with your past self. Let's say we're, I don't know the planets they use in Star Trek, so let's just have ourselves beamed down to Mars. And let's do it the second way that Alex has in mind, so it's just the forms and not the matter that go, as Aristotle might put it. And there's a malfunction, and there's two of me. Now, the first point is that it looks like these would not be the same person as each other.
Right.
They're in different places. They might have exactly the same memories and emotions and feelings right at the moment, but those will quickly begin to become different. I mean, suppose one of me stumbles and feels pain and the other one doesn't. Then our minds aren't identical.
But wait a minute.
I can't find out what the other one is thinking by introspection.
But wait a minute, though. Don't they both have equal claim to be John Perry, right? Because one says, I remember being John Perry. I remember marrying Frenchie. I remember raising my sons and daughter. I remember all this stuff. And the other one says, hey, I remember being John Perry, right? And if they both went to Frenchie and said, I'm John, she wouldn't have any basis for saying one is John and that one isn't.
No, she would say, oh, God, one was bad enough.
Right.
I'm going to be mad at two of these guys. They're going to get two salaries.
Whatever claim the one has to be John
Maybe
Perry.
Now we'll get the yard done every so often if there's at least two of them. They can't both procrastinate.
But whatever claim the one has to be John Perry, the other one has equal claim to be John Perry.
Well, this is why you get a paradox. Assuming that the two new guys on the moon or on Mars, wherever I was, are not identical with each other, then they can't both be identical with me before, because identity doesn't work that way. You can't have A is equal to B and C is equal to B unless A is equal to C.
Yeah.
If they have an equal claim, you can't choose between them, so it seems like neither of them gets to be me. But they both have the same claim on being me that either of them would have had if they were the only one.
Right. Well, suppose I said, look, tomorrow I'm going to put you in a machine and I'm going to obliterate you. You'd say, oh, shucks. And I say, don't feel bad, because after I obliterate you, there's going to be another guy, a kind of deluded guy, who's just going to come into existence when I make it happen, but he's going to think he's you.
Would that
make you happy?
No, but if you're trying to sell this as a low-cost way to, say, get to the East Coast, you shouldn't put it that way.
Right, exactly.
You say, want to get to the East Coast, no air sickness, half the price.
Right.
I can do it for you.
Yeah,
and
right.
Then they'll meet up with somebody like Alex who explain what they've done, and then they'll get very miserable.
So I don't know, Alex, if we've solved your conundrum.
But I can give you an excellent book you can read about all this, Alex.
All right. What is that?
It's one I wrote. And it's called A Dialogue on Personal Identity and Immortality. You can buy it from Hackett Publishing Company. It's a little dialogue and makes good reading, makes a wonderful gift to give to your mother, your father. You might want to buy a couple hundred copies of it, Alex,
so, Alex,
given your interest in this.
Are you a philosopher?
I think about philosophy.
This is excellent, because you asked an excellent question. You pose an excellent series of puzzles, and it is a longstanding philosophical puzzle. But I hope you've had some fun and we've given you some insight.
Yeah.
Enjoy coding for the rest of the day.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Philosophy Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Dave Fusaro, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association and from various groups at Stanford University.
And even more support from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and from the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.